content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week edition dated March 2nd, 2012. Now we'll begin, as we usually do, from the main story section. Our first item is entitled, Iran's Mixed Message on Its Nuclear Program. What happened? Iran frustrated Western governments with conflicting messages this past week, barring United Nations inspectors from visiting a suspected nuclear weapons facility just days after it had offered to revive long-dormant negotiations with the West. The team from the International Atomic Energy Agency had hoped to examine the Parchin military base, 19 miles southeast of Tehran, where Iran is suspected of experimenting with nuclear warhead designs. But the regime blocked the request. In a letter to the European Union, Iran last week offered to resume talks with world powers over its nuclear program, which it insists is only for peaceful purposes. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton called the letter an important step, but stressed that the seriousness of the proposal wasn't yet clear. With tensions in the region mounting, General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, urged Israel to give international sanctions more time to work. Dempsey said that an Israeli strike would only set back the regime's atomic program by a couple of years and could spark retaliatory action against U.S. targets in the Gulf or Afghanistan. In Tehran, Iranian General Mohammad Hejazi warned that his country would launch preemptive attacks if it believed the U.S. or Israel were planning military action. "We do not wait for enemies to strike us," said Hejazi. Now here's what the editorial said. "We'll soon know if Iran's offer to negotiate is yet another attempt to buy more time," said the Financial Times. "The regime must offer real access to all its nuclear sites, not just bluster about preconditions. For negotiations to have any chance of succeeding, the West needs to accept that Tehran will never give up its civilian nuclear program to generate electricity, which is popular with Iranian citizens. The key will be deciding what level of Iranian nuclear capability the world can live with." "The U.S. isn't trying very hard to get Iran to the table," said the Wall Street Journal. "The point of coercive diplomacy is to make an adversary understand that the cost of its bad behavior will be very, very high. But by publicly advising Israel against an attack, Dempsey and the Obama administration have all but told Tehran that it can develop nuclear weapons without fear of serious military consequences. The White House's display of weakness will only increase Tel Aviv's anxiety about U.S. resolve and thus may drive Israel's leadership to strike sooner." Now here's what the columnist said. "The international sanctions are clearly working," said Dennis Ross in the New York Times. "Iran is more isolated than ever. Food prices there are soaring, and the regime's oil revenues are dropping. Eventually, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, will have to decide what poses a greater threat to his rule, ending his quest for nuclear weapons or stubbornly pursuing them as crippling economic pressures mount." Yet, as long as Khamenei is in charge, a sea change in policy seems unlikely, said Alastair Lyon in Reuters.com. "He's deeply steeped in his death to America worldview and fears that any opening to the West would allow foreign influences to dilute Iran's Islamic purity. Unfortunately," said Amir Tahiri in the New York Post, "Obama is a sucker for multilateralism, so he'll bite on this latest Iranian offer to negotiate. Iran has been playing this game since 2006 while continuing its program to build a bomb." But would an Iranian bomb really be such a catastrophe? Asked Fareed Zakaria in the Washington Post. The Israelis say Americans do not understand how it feels to have a hostile nuclear-armed nation talking about wiping it off the map. But we do. During the Cold War, the Soviet Union had thousands of nuclear missiles pointed at the U.S., while its leaders vowed to bury us and spread communism to every corner of the globe. In the end, the prospect of mutual destruction kept the Soviet nukes and ours in their silos. Israel could easily devastate Iran with its own arsenal of sophisticated nukes, so even if Iran succeeds in building a crude nuclear device, are the mullahs likely to launch first? The next item from the week this week, more pain at the gas pump. Gas prices hit a record seasonal high last week, but assuring that surging fuel costs will be a key issue in the presidential race. The average price of a gallon of gasoline across the country is now $3.59, the highest it's ever been at this time of year. Prices are likely to rise further as the summer driving season hikes demand, analysts said, and could hit $5 a gallon in high-tax states like New York and California. The White House said tensions in Iran and an unusually cold winter in Europe had caused the price of oil to surge to $106 a barrel. But Republican presidential nominees blamed President Obama for the soaring prices. His policies have done everything they can to slow down energy production, said Rick Santorum. Blame Wall Street for the rising gas prices, said Kevin G. Hall in the Seattle Times. Oil speculators are piling into the market, betting that oil prices will surge in the summer and torquing the Iranian fear factor into ever higher prices. Domestic policies aren't a factor. Oil is plentiful, demand is weak, and the U.S. actually sold more gasoline than it used last year. What's costing us at the pump is rampant financial speculation. So what is the president doing about it, said Michael Graham in the Boston Herald. He has refused to ease market jitters by opening up offshore leases and angered Wall Street by cheerily vetoing the Keystone XL pipeline from Canada. Perhaps he agrees with Energy Secretary Stephen Chu's 2008 statement that we need European-style gas prices to get us to trade in our gas guzzlers for green vehicles. Well, Mr. President, I am in the market for a trade-in this November. High gas prices are actually the last thing Obama wants, said Ron Klain in Bloomberg.com. If they hit $5 a gallon, angry voters will desert him in droves. That prospect leaves him with a troubling dilemma. Does he abandon principled positions on the environment by expanding oil drilling and cutting gas taxes, or suffer the political consequences of doing nothing at all? The White House needs to come up with a plan before the gauge says E for economic peril. The next item from the main story section, doubts over Greece's bailout. European Union finance ministers signed off this past week on a $172 billion bailout package for Greece, allowing the country to dodge immediate default. But the tortured 11th-hour negotiations in Brussels did not allay fears that the deal would condemn Greece to years of recession and do little to stem the eurozone's ongoing debt crisis. The latest round of debt relief aims to reduce Greece's debt level, currently 160% of GDP, to a still crippling 120% by 2020. In exchange, Greek leaders have agreed to brutal public spending cuts and layoffs, tax reforms, and unprecedented EU oversight of the national budget. And private sector holders of Greek debt face a 70% write-down of their bonds. Having avoided the nightmare scenario, said Greek Finance Minister Evangelos Venizelos, Greece should embrace this new opportunity. Greece's nightmare is far from over, said Christopher Dickey in the DailyBeast.com. Its economy shrank 7% last year, and unemployment is at 21%. That dismal picture won't improve unless the economy grows, a nearly impossible feat under the latest austerity reforms. An EU IMF report leaked this week admits that Greece could well wind up with the same level of debt in 2020 that it has now. There's really no relief in sight. Things didn't have to be this bad, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Greece's crisis has been made far worse by the misguided measures imposed on it over the past 2 years. When high-debt governments slash spending in the face of high unemployment, they get deeply depressed economies. Perhaps Greece's lot will now convince people on both sides of the Atlantic that we cannot cut our way to prosperity. Greece's sovereignty may have suffered the greatest blow, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Europe's solution for Greece has been to lurch even further in the direction of central control at the expense of local democracy. Europe's strongest countries are calling the shots, and everything is worse for Greece. That's hardly what the Euro's founders had imagined. Now let's turn to the controversy of the week. Santorum pulling the GOP too far to the right? Rick Santorum may be leading Mitt Romney in the polls, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. But the sweater-vested Pennsylvanian reminded us this week of why the GOP would get slaughtered with Santorum as the nominee. In a speech on President Obama's energy policy, the devout Catholic veered off into an attack on Obama's phony theology that he later explained elevates the earth above man. Then Santorum set off a fresh controversy by saying he opposes prenatal testing for pregnant women because it can lead to abortions of fetuses with birth defects. With Santorum hitting the Republican ticket this November, one GOP senator moaned this week, "We'd lose 35 states and the House of Representatives, too." Santorum's social conservatism would be less problematic if he weren't so abrasive, said David Kuhn in RealClearPolitics.com. But he has compared the battle to defeat President Obama to the struggle against Hitler in the World War II. And this week, a tape surfaced of Santorum telling a crowd in 2008 that Satan has his sights on the United States of America. This fire and brimstone rhetoric is clearly helping Santorum with the social conservatives who vote in GOP primaries, but it's a major turnoff to the independent voters who elect American presidents. Santorum's style of social conservatism is deeply American, said Rich Lowry in National Review, despite what the media and political elite would have you believe. He walks the walk as the father of seven children, including one with a serious birth defect that often leads other couples to choose abortion. His passionate intensity plays very well with blue-collar voters, many of whom share Santorum's belief that issues of family and culture are inextricably bound up with the struggles of the working class. Santorum's appeal to these voters is not hard to understand, said Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. His world view summons the ghosts of religious and patriarchal orders that once regulated much of working class life, for which many conservatives are deeply nostalgic. But Americans also value personal freedom, said Connor Friedsdorf in the Atlantic.com. Are voters really going to hand the presidency to a man who wants to criminalize abortion, even in the case of incest and rape, opposes contraception even for married couples, and famously equated homosexuality with man-on-dog sex? Republican presidential candidates don't have to be Ron Paul libertarian, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. But Santorum seems actively hostile to the idea that people have a right to make their own moral decisions. Nominating a smug, scold who wants to lecture Americans about their sex lives would ensure a Democratic rout in November. Santorum should probably avoid the weeds of theological debate, said William McGurn in the Wall Street Journal. He should also stop criticizing contraception. But the core of his appeal is that he's a conviction politician, and even those who might not share all his views are hungry for a nominee who does not bend with the wind. Perhaps so, said David Weigel in Slate.com, but even Santorum now realizes that as frontrunner, he needs to tone down the harsh rhetoric. Santorum 2.0 is saying that gays should be treated with respect, and noting that as a senator, he voted for two international aid programs that provided contraception. His problem is that, as the 2008 Satan speech illustrates, Santorum 1.0 has left a motherload of extremist positions and off-the-wall statements for the media and his opponents to mine, and the digging has only just begun. Now, in the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the popular column, Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Always entertaining, for sure. It was a good week for Austin Smith, 15, of Michigan, who saved his grandfather's life by lifting a 2,000-pound Buick a foot off the ground after the car slipped off cinder blocks and trapped the older man underneath. The teen attributed his amazing burst of strength to all the adrenaline. It was a good week for liking it hot after New Mexico State University scientists identified the world's hottest pepper, the Trinidad Moruga scorpion. On a scale of hotness, it rates at 1.2 million Scoville units, compared with 5,000 units for a jalapeno. And it was a good week for having a knack with freeze-dried cream chicken, after NASA announced it was seeking volunteers to serve as chefs during a simulated four-month mission to Mars on a Hawaiian lava flow. Applicants will be asked to whip up tasty meals from space-appropriate packaged supplies while wearing spacesuits. And it was a bad week for road trips. Road is spelled R-H-O-D-E here. I'll tell you why in a second. After Vice President Joe Biden's office released a schedule showing him visiting Providence, Rhode Island. There, the road was spelled R-O-A-D. It was a bad week for impatience after a San Francisco man decided to swerve around a lane of cars that had come to a standstill and drove his Porsche 911 into a lane of freshly poured cement. The car sank about a foot and got stuck. And it was a bad week for stoners after a Florida teenager was charged with crawling into a window to steal what he thought was a marijuana plant. "You stupid little brat, it's a tomato plant," the plant's owner called out as she chased him right down the street. Now, from the Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4, we'll turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first item is Jackson's racial politics. Samuel L. Jackson had a very simple reason for supporting Barack Obama for president in 2008, said Kevin Powell in Ebony. "I voted for Barack because he was black," says the 63-year-old actor. "That's why other folks vote for other people, because they look like them. That's American politics, pure and simple. His message didn't mean anything to me. Not all black men," Jackson thinks, "could win over white voters like Obama did. When it comes down to it, they wouldn't have elected a nigga," and this is his words, he says, "because what's a nigga? A nigga is scary. Obama ain't scary. Niggas don't have beers at the White House, and they don't let some white dude while you in the middle of a speech call them a liar. They also would have stopped the meeting right there and said, 'Who the heck said that?' Jackson doesn't apologize for using the N-word, nor does he see it as an insult. In fact, he uses it to describe himself. I've said to white Hollywood folks, first thing you need to understand is I am a nigga, he says. I'm a nice guy, but there are certain things that go click, and I'll become that guy y'all worry about at night. That's why y'all hire me. I bring something genuine about that type of guy who scares white people they can safely watch on the screen. And just as a footnote from your loyal reader here, I hate using that word, but I felt that I needed to in order to portray it. It was used so intently in this particular article. Let's move on to the next one from the People section. The actress who beguiled Hitchcock. Tippi Hedren has mixed feelings about her mentor, Alfred Hitchcock, said Jeffrey McNabb in the London Independent. The director, then in his 60s, groomed the young Hedren for stardom and gave her the leading role in the 1963 classic The Birds. But he was so infatuated with the glacial blonde that when she refused to sleep with him, he kept her under contract at $600 a week, but stopped her from working for almost 2 years. It was an extremely difficult time. To be the object of someone's obsession is horrible, says Hedren. I demanded to get out of the contract, but he just said, well, you can't. You've got your daughter to raise and your parents are getting older. I said, no, I want to get out. The people who love me do not want me in this situation. Yet Hitchcock's obsession with Hedren had its upside. He was such a fabulous drama coach, she says. He gave me an education in filmmaking that would have taken 15 years for me to acquire. He had me sit in on meetings in every phase of making a motion picture. Now, 82, she chuckles affectionately when recalling Hitchcock's pension for reciting dirty limericks. He ruined my career, she says, but he didn't ruin my life. Adele's fury at her father. Don't talk to Adele about her dad, said Jonathan Van Meter in Vogue. When the British singer was 3 years old, her father, Welsh plumber Mark Evans, walked out on her and her mother. The Grammy winner has had almost no contact with him over the past decade. But last March, Evans sold his story to a British tabloid, claiming that his own love of jazz and blues had shaped Adele's music. I was actually ready to start trying to have a relationship with him, she says, her voice deepening with rage. He's blown it. He will never hear from me again. There is nothing that would upset me more than my dad being bribed by the press. The 23-year-old sighs and then returns to the subject, even more furious. To come back after 10 years and be like, maybe her problem with men comes down to me, how dare you comment on my life? It makes my blood boil. It blows my mind. I love her so much, really. Why are you telling me that through a newspaper? What would she do if she bumped into her father in the street? If I ever see him, I will spit in his face, she said. You're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for March 2nd, 2012. Thanks so much for joining me today. Our next section is the briefing, and this one is entitled Brokered Conventions. If a majority of Republican primary voters fail to settle on a presidential nominee, exactly what happens? Well, what is a brokered convention? It's a throwback to another era in American politics, full of drama, deal-making, and chaos. Today, both the Democratic and Republican parties require presidential candidates to amass more than 50% of delegates who pledge to vote for that candidate at the national convention. Those conventions are usually staged, predictable affairs. But if none of the candidates wins the support of an outright majority, the party's nominee must be decided at the convention. The delegates are released from their pledges and are free to vote for whomever they want. In the frantic horse trading or brokering that follows, various factions seek to cobble together a majority of delegates for their favored candidates. Anyone can be nominated from the floor, meaning that new contenders could suddenly emerge. why the current talk about a brokered convention? Some Republicans and conservative activists are hoping for one because they're not sold on any of the potential nominees. Deeply committed conservatives believe Mitt Romney is too moderate to represent the party, while more moderate Republicans worry that Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich have records of extremism that will frighten off the independent voters whose support is vital to win the presidency. About 50% of Republican voters still say they're unhappy with the candidates, and some in the party believe a brokered convention would prompt a dark horse candidate like Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, or even Sarah Palin to put himself or herself forward and unite the party. Among those who think a brokered convention is a distinct possibility when Republicans convene in Tampa on August 27th are conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh, Senator Jim DeMint, and former House Majority Leader Dick Armey. "It's possible," said Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, "and I think on the whole it might turn out to be a good thing." Has it ever happened before? Yes, brokered conventions were common before the era of presidential primary elections, when party power brokers decided which nominee their delegates would support in the proverbial smoke-filled rooms. Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, and Franklin D. Roosevelt were all nominated in brokered conventions. The last brokered Republican convention was in 1948. When the three major rivals of frontrunner Thomas E. Dewey, Robert Taft, Harold Stassen, and Arthur H. Vandenberg stayed in the race until the convention, plotting to combine their votes to stop him from winning the nomination. But the three men could not decide which of them should be the unifying candidate, allowing Dewey to seal the nomination on the third ballot. Dewey went on to lose to Democrat Harry S. Truman later that year. Why don't they happen anymore? Well, both parties changed their rules to make brokered conventions far less likely. These changes came after the disastrous 1968 Democratic National Convention, when Vice President Hubert Humphrey was handed the nomination without winning a single primary. Violent rioting on the streets of Chicago ensued. A few years later, first the Democrats and then the Republicans adopted the system of primaries and caucuses that we have today, giving more power to rank-and-file voters and diminishing the importance of the convention. Even so, there have been several close calls. Gerald Ford only narrowly avoided a brokered convention in 1976, for example, by convincing uncommitted delegates to swing his way at the last moment. He wound up with 52% of delegates against lone rival Ronald Reagan's 48%. Could it happen this year? It's possible, but only under a perfect storm of circumstances. Rick Santorum and Newt Gingrich would both have to remain in the race and win some primaries in the Midwest and the South while limiting Mitt Romney's victories. The three candidates would then have to split the vote in large states like Texas and California, where hundreds of delegates are handed out proportionately. If all that happened, no candidate might wind up with a majority. Most analysts, however, think this scenario is unlikely. Why do they think one Republican will emerge? A single candidate nearly always takes a significant lead well before the primaries are over, causing a bandwagon effect. The media crowns a presumptive nominee, and supporters and financial donors desert the also-rans. In addition, most party leaders will try very hard to prevent a brokered convention, fearing that it would put the party's divisions squarely in the national spotlight 2 months before the presidential election. If a dark horse candidate got nominated, moreover, he or she would have less than 10 weeks to raise funds, put together a campaign team, and prepare for debates with a well-funded incumbent president, whose organization has been preparing for this election for years. Folks in the media and in the political punditry like to talk about it because it's like their dream come true, says Chris Christie. I don't think it's going to happen in 2012. And our footnote to today's briefing column, the longest convention. Brokered conventions produce great drama, but they often leave parties headed for defeat in November. The 1924 Democratic Convention, which lasted 17 days and required 103 ballots, is perhaps the most extreme example. The party was deeply divided that year along religious, social, and geographical lines. Al Smith, a Catholic opponent of Prohibition, was the liberal choice of Northeastern voters. William Gibbs McAdoo, a Protestant defender of Jim Crow, was preferred by Dixie Democrats. The convention was held in New York City during a heat wave and was picketed by Irish and German immigrants, pro- and anti-temperance activists, and hooded, cross-burning Klan members. Local newspapers branded it the Klan Bake. There was bitter infighting on and off the convention floor, and both leading candidates withdrew from the convention after the 99th ballot, when it was clear that neither would win. The party ended up selecting lawyer John Davis as a compromise candidate. But the damage was done. Davis ended up winning only 12 states, handing Calvin Coolidge a landslide re-election victory. Now let's look at the best columns in the U.S. this past week in the opinion of The Week magazine. The first one is entitled Super PACs Give Voters More Choice by Josh Krushauer in the National Journal. Despite all the hand-wringing over super PACs, said Josh Krushauer, they are actually good for democracy. Campaign finance laws that limit contributions always serve to protect incumbents who have all the perks of power at their disposal to help them raise cash. With the rise of super PACs, challengers can now close this fundraising gap. Well-heeled donors like Sheldon Adelson and Foster Freese have kept Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum in the fight for the GOP nomination long after their own funds ran out. In the general election to come, super PACs will give the Republican nominee a way to compete with President Obama's fundraising juggernaut. Good government types always bemoan the influence of money on politics, but evidence shows little connection between strict campaign finance laws and good governance. Virginia allows unlimited contributions and runs clean elections. New Jersey has strict campaign finance laws and is plagued by political corruption. Attempts to keep money out of politics are not only futile, they only serve to give an unfair advantage to those in power. The next kind of, item here is Exaggerating the China Threat by Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. Is the U.S. locked in a deadly struggle with Beijing? Asked Steve Chapman. During Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping's recent visit to the United States, Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney attacked President Obama for showing weakness in the face of the Chinese threat and suggested that a trade war might be necessary. But if China is an adversary, China is the best kind to have. The Chinese remain no match for us militarily. We have 11 aircraft carriers. They have one, bought secondhand from the Ukraine. We have almost 3,700 combat aircraft to their 307. And unlike rogue states of the past, such as the Soviet Union, post-Mao China has not used force to seize territory from its neighbors. Instead, it has remained focused on internal economic development. Over the past two decades, China's growth has transformed a backward communist nation into a thriving capitalist one. If we believe its trade practices are unfair, we can work through the World Trade Organization or direct diplomatic pressure for change. China, of course, will never be a close ally so long as it remains an authoritarian state, but it is not fated to be an enemy unless we decide to make it one. And our next column, The Drug Problem We Ignore, by Frank Bruni in the New York Times. Everyone knows that Whitney Houston was a drug addict, said Frank Bruni. She freely admitted that on several occasions and went into rehab more than once. But she continued to drink heavily at times, and while the cause of her death remained to be determined, it appears that alcohol played a role. She was reportedly drinking and taking prescription pills in the hours before she was discovered lifeless in a bathtub. and our censorious public discussions about substance abuse, drinking often gets a pass. That's because it's legal, safe in moderation, and widely enjoyed as a sociable pastime. But alcohol abuse kills far more people than powders, capsules, and vials. About a third of the U.S. adult population is either addicted to alcohol or binge drinks dangerously. Booze seeds and squires a broad range of diseases, from cirrhosis to various forms of cancer, and contributes to tens of thousands of deaths from shootings, falls, and drunk driving. I'm not suggesting we bring back prohibition, but if we're going to discuss America's drug problem with any honesty, then we shouldn't edit drinking out of the picture. And now we'll flip to the back of the Week magazine for this week for the last word. The title of this specific article for this week is Lessons for Living. We have much to learn, says Carl Pillemer, from people who've led long, full lives. We are on the verge of losing an irreplaceable natural resource. The inexorable process of human aging is depriving us of one of the most extraordinary groups of human beings that has ever lived, America's older generation. The last veteran of World War I has died. Those of World War II are now in their 80s. The youngest children of the Great Depression have reached their late 70s. When this generation has passed, where will we go to recover the lessons they learned about life? For 5 years, I have collected the advice and wisdom of over 1,000 of our elders, experts, as I call them, about surviving and thriving in a difficult world. Here is what 8 of them had to say. Marry someone like you. April Stern, 71, and her husband Steve were married for 47 years until Steve's death. April is a highly respected community leader who directed several local organizations, and Steve was a well-known local psychotherapist. They were deeply in love throughout their long relationship. I think we modeled a good marriage for our children. Our children even talked about it as being important to them, says April. It sounds simple, but you have to like each other. Be friends. Try to get past the initial heaving and panting and make sure there's a real friendship underneath that. I don't think you have to have identical interests, but you've got to have shared values. That is quite important. That's what's critical. Yeah, I think values are probably the most important thing. And we both love certain kinds of things. We both loved movies, good movies, and part of our courtship involves staying up all night and figuring out what an Ingmar Bergman film really meant. We both love to read, and we love to talk about what we'd read. A similar sense of humor, that was a very important part of our life together. In fact, just 2 weeks before he died, we were talking one night and he said something and I just dissolved in laughter. And he looked at me so self-satisfied and said, "I can still make you laugh after all these years." And he could. Honor your vows. Eugene Earnhardt, 80, is a trim, handsome man with close-cropped gray hair. Eugene's speech is halting due to the effects of a stroke, and it took him a while to tell me his most important life lesson. He did so with such emotion that he was forced to stop at times to collect himself, but in the end, he was relieved at the knowledge that others might profit from his experience. Eugene's career involved frequent relocation and extensive business travel, which was bound up with a life regret he cannot get over, he told me. Listen, this is very important, and it's that people should respect fidelity. I'm the worst one in the world to appreciate that because I was not a faithful husband, and I regret it. I think it was the fact that I roamed around the country in my work, and I really want to make this point about how fidelity is important to marriage. That's what I'd do over if you could. Oh, definitely, I was an idiot. And she was a wonderful wife. I could never make it up to her. Even to the end, I was unfaithful. fidelity wasn't there. It's hard for me to say this, and sometimes I get really depressed about it, but I tell people, don't ramble around the country doing what I did. Faithfulness is one of the most important things that people should cling to. The next suggestion from Lessons for Living, share your kids' lives. Clayton Greenough, 79, has very close relationships with his son and daughter, both of whom settled near him as adults. When asked for his lessons about child rearing, he reflected on the importance of going along with children's interests and making them shared activities. Maybe it's an old-fashioned way of speaking, but I feel that it's pretty important to stick with them. When my son was a sophomore in high school, I started putting up a shed in our backyard, and he was taking a shop class in high school at the time. I had him help me there, and before I knew it, I'd come home from work, and he'd be sitting with a toolbox waiting to go ahead with some work. And this led him down a road where he actually saw the need for measuring and things like that and started to recognize that there is some value to arithmetic and mathematics. He eventually wound up being a mechanical designer. Now, if I hadn't been available to him at that time, I'm not sure what course he might have taken. So many of the things that he's doing now were initiated because we spent time together. The fact that there was somebody who was there and interested in what he was interested in. The next lesson for living, learn from bad experiences. Sam Winston, 81, trained as an engineer, but also worked in marketing as a general manager. He attributes his considerable career success specifically to his ability to learn from jobs he didn't like. The key, he says, is to see them as learning experiences and to take advantage of any opportunity to gather knowledge about an industry or occupation. One important thing for young people is to be observant. No matter what the task is, whether you like it or not, it's very important to learn everything you can about what's happening around you. You never know when that may be of great value later. I've had many different experiences throughout my life where I really didn't like what I had to do, and I would feel that what I was doing was inconsequential. But the lessons I learned doing those things played an important part in my life. For example, I had to work my way through college, and many jobs you may consider meaningless. Later on, they were very valuable for me as an employer to help me understand my people. I would tell younger people that no matter what the experience is, learn. See what's happening. The next lesson for living, choose happiness. Marianne Rumsey, 76, has suffered from a discouraging number of health problems in recent years. She sees the sense of fragility that belongs to these experiences as directly contributing to her ability to save her life. With physical problems you have gone through, the day-to-day becomes more important because you don't know what tomorrow is. That became much clearer to me after I'd had my 2 or 3 heart episodes. Enjoy each day if you feel fine today. There are no guarantees for the future. It sounds trite, but it's so true. Really is, and we all forget about it, but it's important to remember. Lighten up. Let's look at things and be happy instead of being glum and negative. Walk cheerfully on the face of the earth. The next lesson for living is stay connected. Chris Schultz, 83, was raised a Lutheran in the upper Midwest, and his description of his small town, the population was 200, upbringing, sounds like a lot like Garrison Keillor's Lake Wobegon. He emphasizes the community he finds at church rather than his spiritual experience. I'm very active in a local church. We try to go every Sunday, but I'm not a particularly strong believer in the stuff that's associated with what churches say they're all about, the afterlife kinds of questions, that sort of thing. There's one thing, though, that is important to me, and it's the reason I participate. That is the sense of community that can come from people who also are concerned about the world. For people who don't take part in that church community, I think their lives are less rich. I grant that you can get it from other sources, but the church has some unique characteristics about it. The next lesson for living, accept life as it is. In Cecil Lampkin's living room, a wall of windows looks out through the still bare trees to a calm lake below. This house has been Cecil's home for over 50 years, and only she recently gave up daily swims, she said, because I can't get down the stairs anymore. Widowed several years earlier, after 68 years of marriage, Cecil, who is 92, explained that later life has brought her a sense of wholeness, acceptance, and the ability to enjoy small pleasures. I am much clearer now. I say that as an older person, not just as an adult, but as an older person, things are much clearer. I was just telling my daughter, I think I'm happier now than I've ever been in my life. And I've been thinking about why it is that I'm happier now. I came up with a lot of stuff. First of all, things that were important to me are no longer important, or not as important. The second thing is I don't feel responsible in the same way that I used to feel. I've been a pretty responsible person, but I don't feel that responsibility anymore. My children are in charge of their lives, and whatever they do with them, they will do with them. And I live in a place, my house, that I love. In the summer here, it is wonderful, and I live outdoors at that time. My family comes, friends come, and I use it like a vacation. I've also given up feeling that I have to entertain people. If there's someone coming up, they will bring such and such. It's very liberating for me. And I just feel the contentedness that I've never felt before. I've heard other people my age say the exact same thing. And the last bit of wisdom here from Lessons for Living, don't worry about dying. Rosemary Brewster, 90, is a regular churchgoer and has been all her life. When I asked her, "Do you believe in life after death?" she replied, "I often wonder about that, I think, and I wonder if there really is one. And I'm going to find out. I wouldn't bother worrying about it too much because I'm going to find out." Rosemary pointed out that her feelings about death had changed greatly in her later life. You know, when you're stronger, you go to bed and you think about death and, oh my God, or if you're sick, what if I don't wake up? I don't think that anymore. Now that I'm old, I'm at peace when I go to bed. I figure if I don't wake up, well, maybe I'll be someplace nicer. It's just a funny thing. I used to be scared to go to sleep when I wasn't feeling good, but not anymore. I'm not ready to die or anything like that, but I'm just not afraid to die. I think there's something on the other side, and I've got some sisters over there who will be waiting for me. I'm not worried at all. And that's something I didn't think I'd ever come to terms with. And that wonderful article is from 30 Lessons for Living, Tried and True Advice from the Wisest Americans by Carl Pillemer, Ph.D., published by arrangement with Hudson Street Press. And from The Last Word, we'll turn to the Talking Points section of The Week magazine for this week, March 2nd, 2012. The first item here is entitled, Contraception. Is the GOP waging war on women? What year is it again? Said Pat Morrison in the Los Angeles Times. Anyone watching Representative Daryl Issa's congressional hearing on the Obama administration's contraception policy last week might have felt as if they'd stepped into the 1950s. The conservative Republican, who is chairman of the Oversight and Government Reform Committee, initially did not invite a single woman to testify and, in fact, rejected one woman who wanted to talk about her need for birth control pills to address a medical problem. Instead, five male clergymen appeared before the first panel. After an uproar, Issa then brought in two token women who sided with the Catholic Church's moral condemnation of contraception. No wonder three of the panel's Democratic members walked out in protest. "I feel like I'm waking up on the set of Mad Men," said Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington. "Have Republicans completely lost their minds?" said Michelle Goldberg in the DailyBeast.com. "Now they're not only vowing to ban abortion, they're challenging the need and morality of contraception, even for married women. For the GOP, this could be another Terry Schiavo moment." No one should be surprised, said the New Republic in an editorial. Ever since the Republicans took control of the House of Representatives last year, this heavily religious, male-dominated party has displayed a regressive, even radical attitude toward women's rights. First came the GOP's attempts to defund Planned Parenthood last year, then the casually ugly statements of conservatives like Rick Santorum, who has smugly called for all abortions to be criminalized, even in the case of rape or incest last week. His billionaire backer Foster Freese crudely joked that back in the good old days, contraception consisted of telling women to place aspirin between their legs so they'd keep them closed. Over the last 40 years, women have successfully fought for equality in this society, and the ability of women to make their own reproductive decisions has been a central part of this revolution. Republicans have put women on notice that these advances are all in jeopardy. "There's no war on women," said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. "Liberals would like to persuade female voters that their access to contraception is in danger, but that's nonsense. By any reasonable standard, we are one of the most lavishly contracepted societies in the history of the planet. Some 99% of sexually active women have used some method of birth control, and condoms are cheap and available in almost every drugstore in the nation, with no stigma attached. The real war here is on religious liberty," said Catherine Jean Lopez, also in NationalReview.com. "Obama's policy on mandatory contraception coverage treats pregnancy as a disease and dismisses as irrelevant those who deeply disagree. It's not about sex, it's about tyranny." If you want to talk about tyranny, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com, then let's look at what Republicans are now doing in Virginia. This week, the state legislature passed a bill requiring all women to submit to an ultrasound before having an abortion. Since most abortions take place before the heartbeat is detectable from outside the body, the ultrasounds will be conducted by a vaginal probe. That's right. In order to exercise their constitutional right to an abortion, women will be forcibly penetrated and humiliated at the whim of the state. In any other state of circumstances, that would constitute rape. "The Virginia bill is a major tactical error by Republicans," said David Frum in the DailyBeast.com. "In general, conservatives had the high moral ground here. With his contraception mandate, Obama trampled over the long-standing tradition of giving religious institutions an exemption from rules that conflict with their religious teachings. But now conservatives are engaging in extremism of their own. When they compel physical intrusion into women's bodies in Virginia, it dangerously complicates the narrative." In coming weeks and months, the battle of perceptions will be critical, said Gerald Seib in the Wall Street Journal. If Democrats succeed in portraying the philosophical conflict as a war on women, then the political rewards will be immense. Polls show that 80% of voters don't consider birth control wrong. But if Republicans can frame it as a question of religious liberty, the benefits will be almost as great. About 50% of Americans disapprove of Obama's mandate on religious institutions. The party that wins the perception battle may wind up with control of Congress and in the White House in 2012. The next item from Talking Points is entitled Government Aid, America on the Dole. The government safety net is not just for the poor anymore, said Benjamin Applebaum and Robert Gebeloff in the New York Times. One out of five Americans, 67 million people, now relies on federal aid to obtain food, housing, education, or health care, or to cover lost wages due to unemployment, according to a new study by the Heritage Foundation. "We can't afford this," said Con Carroll in WashingtonExaminer.com. The original purpose purpose of government assistance was to help the very poor get back on their feet, not to maintain the middle class in a comfortable lifestyle paid for by working taxpayers. Government assistance programs now cost $2.5 trillion a year, about 70% of the federal budget. If the U.S. wants to avoid a Greek-like debt apocalypse, we've got to reverse the growing culture of dependency. Some parts of America are more dependent than others, said George Packer in NewYorker.com. A map showing areas of greatest reliance on public benefits corresponds with weird exactness to the map of red America. The South, Appalachia, and rural areas receive the most government help, but these are the same regions that gave birth to the Tea Party movement and are the most rabid hotbeds of anti-tax, anti-government rage. There's a lot of self-delusion out there, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. One recent survey found that 44% of people on Social Security and 43% of those on unemployment insist they have never used a government program. If Americans realize the large and vital role government plays in the lives of seniors, the disabled, and working families, the notion that this is a fundamental conservative country would evaporate. I wouldn't be so sure, said Will Wilkinson in Economist.com. Yes, half the households in the country now receive government assistance of one kind or another, but our culture still prizes independence and self-reliance above all, so many Americans find this dependency humiliating. We need to resign the safety net to go with rather than against our culture's grain, turning Social Security and Medicare into forced savings programs where each of us contributes to our own welfare. The more government gives us, said William Beach in the New York Post, the less we in turn give to our families and neighbors and churches in times of need. As government becomes the solution to all problems, it weakens civil society and the human bonds among us. And now, as we get near the end of the program today, a few short items. More than half of births to American women under the age of 30 now occur outside of marriage. For white women with some college education but no degree, the share of out-of-wedlock births has grown especially quickly, climbing from 11% in 1990 to 34% in 2009. About 15% of new marriages in 2010 crossed racial or ethnic lines, double the rate of intermarriage in 1980, according to the Pew Research Center. In the new marriages in 2010, 9% of whites married out, as did 17% of blacks, 26% of Hispanics, and 28% of Asians. And there are now 20,500 nuclear warheads and bombs in the world held by nine nations, according to the Federation of American Scientists. The United States has 8,500 of them out of more than 20,000. We've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.